It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin goes Hollywood in a new exhibit from the Wisconsin Historical Museum.
First, the contenders for the Republican nomination gathered in Milwaukee last night for their fourth debate. The questions focused on the economy with attention to the minimum wage and tax reform. Among the candidates who stood out last night was Marco Rubio, who got big applause when he praised vocational training.
Here's the best way to raise wages. Make America the best place in the world to start a business or expand an existing business. Tax reform and regulatory reform. Bring our debt under control. Fully utilize our energy resources so we can reinvigorate manufacturing. Repeal and replace Obamacare. And make higher education faster and easier to access, especially vocational training. For the life of me, I don't know why we have stigmatized vocational education. Welders make more money than philosophers. We need more welders and less philosophers. And if we do that, if we do this, we will be able to increase wages for millions of Americans, and we will be able to leave everyone better off without making anyone worse off.
It's time for our weekly look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Also today, it's Veterans Day. Yesterday, the Senate passed its first spending bill this year, approving veterans' benefits and military construction.
And we'll take a look at the appeals court ruling blocking President Obama's executive action on immigration. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So Marco Rubio getting big applause for that comment last night about vocational training, comparing the wages of welders and philosophers. Just to focus in on that line, what do you make of that moment?
This is a typical thing, among Republican voters. They hate those Northeast liberal elite college types, and philosophers are those people who supposedly stand out in the crowd and say things without actually doing anything. So, of course, that's going to be a big applause line among Republican voters. And it's a typical remark from Marco Rubio, who knows how to speak to Republican voters during these debates. I don't think there's been a debate so far where Rubio wasn't one of the top three debaters, and last night was no exception. I'm not sure it was his best debate, but it certainly was up there. Jeb Bush, for instance, would trade any of Marco Rubio's debates if you asked him to, and that line is an example why. He just speaks to the Republican primary audience.
Well, speaking of Jeb Bush, people have been looking for him to have a breakaway debate performance, a big night. Some people said he looked a little livelier last night. What did you think?
Sure. I mean, comparatively speaking, he was livelier. He didn't go after Rubio, which is smart. He went after Rubio last time, which was stupid because Rubio knows how to handle those attacks and then turn him into applause lines. So, yeah, I think Bush did do better, but the bar was set so low. I guess the one thing you can say is if you hear the reports out of the Bush camp, the donors aren't going to leave them in droves. This at least keeps them afloat for another month. It was not a disaster as the last one was, but I don't think it was a home run. Maybe it was a single, but I don't think it drove in any runs.
So this is the first debate after the kerfuffle last time around where Republicans complained about the moderating, the questions that were being asked. Did you think there was a significant tone shift in the way that this debate was moderated?
Sure. I mean, certainly the people at Fox Business would like you to believe there was a change in tone, and they mentioned or alluded to the CNBC debate any number of times that this debate is going to be different. And I think, if you're a Republican or a Republican primary voter, you have a little more affiliation for a Fox entity than you do for an NBC-related network. So this is not a big surprise that the Republican voters and the Republican candidates themselves were much bigger fans of this debate. And you know what? It was a relatively substantive debate, so they're not coming out of nowhere with this.
So another emerging narrative of last night is that the Republicans seem more cohesive. They seem to gather together on issues, and instead of attacking each other and engaging in infighting, that they presented more of a unified front, maybe going after Democrats and the supposed proposed nominee, Hillary Clinton. Do you think that that's true? Did this seem like a more unified Republican party?
Sure. I would say it was true. You didn't really see a lot of fighting in the main debate. I think there was a little bit. For instance, Ted Cruz made a remark about sugar subsidies that was clearly aimed at Marco Rubio and maybe previewing some fight they may have down the line. But overall, Republican primary voters don't like when the candidates go after each other. They like when the candidates go after Hillary Clinton. And that is something that I think that these candidates have learned, and that's what they did. I will say one candidate who clearly didn't learn that lesson was Bobby Jindal in the quote-unquote JV debate or the undercard debate, where he did go after Chris Christie. But Jindal has his own sort of methods in what he's aiming for. And I think overall it was just a successful night for most of the Republican candidates, except for maybe John Kasich, who decided that it would be nice to interrupt everybody every 5 seconds.
What about Rand Paul? How do you think he did? There were some commentary out there that he seemed to be a little bit on the outside of the other contenders last night.
Yeah, you know, Rand Paul's an interesting candidate and an interesting personality. Remember, his father, Ron, ran twice the last two times and sort of stood out as this libertarian, isolationist wing type of guy and was able to get a number of votes doing that, but never really came close to the nomination. Rand Paul, at the beginning of the cycle, seemed to say, you know what, I want a chance at the nomination. I'm going to kind of temper my views on some of these foreign policy bits that maybe not exactly in line with the Republican base. But I think he realized that really wasn't getting him anywhere. It wasn't who he was. And so he decided that he was going to be who he was, which is a more libertarian-leaning Republican, perhaps a little more isolationist. And yes, that did end up with him fighting with some of his fellow Republicans, but he was also able to get a number of applause lines, including getting a pretty good lump in against Donald Trump about TPP and whether or not China was involved in that deal, which it wasn't, which Paul pointed out.
So there are a lot of these Republican debates. So the next one is December coming up. But what do you expect the candidates to be doing? And are these debates getting less important, or are they going to start getting more important?
I think they're going to get more important. You know, and one of the reasons that they're going to get more important is, you know, right now most people are not really paying attention to this Republican race. The voting is still a number of months away. The Iowa caucus isn't until February 1st. If you get a bump right now, that really doesn't mean anything. You want a bump later on when people are actually paying attention and determining who they're going to vote for. So I expect that these debates are actually going to get more important as we go on.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538, talking about the latest in national politics. Right now we're talking about the debate. And you're talking about those numbers maybe getting more important. We'll stick with numbers for a while and talk about polling. We're a year out or so from the election. Should we be paying attention to polls right now, or should we just let it wash over us?
I'd say the general election polls. This is something I've written on. The general election polls are things that you just don't want to pay attention to at this point. If we paid attention to them, we would have thought, for instance, that George Herbert Walker Bush in the 1992 campaign was going to walk all over Bill Clinton. That did not happen. We would have thought his son, George W. Bush, was going to walk all over Al Gore. That did not happen. So the polls at this point have an average error of about 10.5 percentage points, and most of the Republican matchups versus Hillary Clinton are very, very tight right now. So it really can go either way. No side really has an advantage, and historically speaking, even if one side did have an advantage, it wouldn't mean anything.
And when do they start mattering? When do the numbers start to be a little more meaningful?
Well, I would say two times. Number one, when the candidates are actually selected by both sides, so, you know, March or April, then you'll see a real kind of climb in the predictability of the polls. And then when they really take off and you really, really have a good idea is after the conventions. Who's ever leading after the conventions is probably going to win the race, unless it's a very, very tight race that could go, you know, if it's a 1 or 2 point race, then it can go either way. But if, say, one candidate has a 7 point lead coming out of the conventions, that candidate's probably going to win the presidency.
I just realized we talked for 10 minutes about the GOP debate, and we didn't talk about Donald Trump at all. What do you think that means? Anything?
I think it does mean that sort of the novelty factor has worn off a little bit with Trump. I think that he also really wasn't that boisterous. I think he's becoming a more serious candidate. I think he sees that he's leading in the polls and realizes, you know, I don't have to do these crazy outlandish things or speak so out of turn in order to keep my standing. I have an actual chance to win, and in order to win, I have to be perceived as at least somewhat serious, and to be perceived as somewhat serious, I have to tone it down a little bit, be a real candidate. And I think Trump recognized that. And I think other candidates realize going after Trump isn't necessarily a quote-unquote Trump card. Excuse my terrible pun there. But, Rick Perry did it. It didn't really work. Bobby Jindal has done it. It hasn't really worked. So they decide, you know, just leave him alone. We'll go the way that we want to go. And Trump is more than happy to allow that to happen.
Okay, so you're saying Trump positioning himself as a more serious candidate, and to that end, he appeared last week on Saturday Night Live.
I mean, this is one of those funny things, right? I guess people rediscovered that SNL's glory days were long behind them at this point. But, you know, I think what Trump also is doing is he's sort of expanding the electorate. Look, President Obama did a terrific job during his presidency of reaching outside into untraditional media sources, you know, talk shows on radio programs that normally wouldn't have politicians on, stuff like that. And Trump is doing the same thing. A lot of people tuned in to watch that SNL episode and sort of put Trump in a different light. I think most people didn't think it was particularly good television, but it did show that Trump was able to make fun of himself. And to that end, for someone who's normally thought of as, oh, I'm all high and mighty, it was a good humanizing experience for him.
So moving on now to look at legislation. Today's Veterans Day, and the Senate passed its first spending bill of the year yesterday to fund veterans benefits and military construction in 2016. Tell us about that first bit of spending action.
So, yeah, they basically, you know, they're going to spend $79 billion. I think it's 79.7 if we're going to get exact. And it's basically, you know, towards veterans programs, making sure that when veterans come back, they'll be able to have the programs that are necessary for them to live fruitful lives or put them right on, or at least put them on the right path. There were some problems with passing this earlier in the year where Democrats wanted to tie it in with a two-year, you know, spending program. But eventually, look, if there's one sort of group of people that you don't want to go after in American politics, it's veterans. People like to hear that veterans are being taken care of. And that's the reason you saw the spending bill pass in the Senate 93-0. And the reason why there were some senators who didn't vote on it is because there's some senators who are running for president. And there are also a senator running for governor down in Louisiana, and David Vitter. So pretty much everyone was on board with this. And it's a nice sort of thing that we have going into Veterans Day. I think most people would agree that we don't treat our veterans with enough respect. And so this hopefully be able to put us on a good pathway to at least helping solve that problem a little bit.
Any indication that this indicates things moving through Congress a little more easily right now, or is this sort of the exception?
Yeah, you know, I mean, yes. I mean, it's certainly not a bad sign, but again, it's veterans. I mean, if they hadn't passed this, then I'd say we were in major trouble. But the fact that they did, I don't necessarily think means that, oh, the government's going to, you know, we're not going to have a problem going forward in December with, you know, sort of negotiations over the budget. That I think is a step too far, but it's certainly not a bad sign.
So looking at the White House now, the president met with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on Monday after a very tense summer between the Obama administration and Israel. What was that meeting like?
You know, I think the meeting was basically, look, guys, Israel's our number one ally in the region. I think most Democrats and most Republicans will agree on that. And it's basically ensuring that that Israel gets the funding, the assistance that they want from the United States government. And it seems like we're moving in that direction, a multi-year deal. But certainly Benjamin Netanyahu and Barack Obama are not besties by any stretch of the imagination. And Republicans like to sort of bash that over the head of Obama. So I think this is just a good sort of PR play for both sides, where Netanyahu's going to say, look, we want to have both parties in the United States on our side. And President Obama is going to say, don't worry, you know, Democratic base that is, you know, that likes Israel. We're going to fund them. We disagreed on the Iran deal, but everything is going to be okay. And we have Israel's back when it comes to Syria and when it comes to the Palestinian territories.
And we leave it there. Thanks a lot, Harry. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time with the latest in national politics.
My name is Wayne, and this is Garth. So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
Well, I'm a regular visitor here, but Milwaukee has certainly had its share of visitors. The French missionaries and explorers were coming here as early as the late 1600s to trade with the Native Americans.
In fact, isn't Milwaukee an Indian name?
Yes, Pete, it is. Actually, it's pronounced Miliwake, which is Algonquin for the good land.
I was not aware of that.
Support for WPR comes from the state.
And that was a clip from the 1992 movie Wayne's World, where Wayne and Garth learn about Milwaukee from their idol, Alice Cooper. It's also part of a new exhibit at the Wisconsin Historical Museum. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. From Orson Welles to Chris Farley to Wayne's World, Wisconsin has left its mark on Hollywood movies and TV shows for decades. Now there's an exhibit in Madison celebrating the state's star-studded legacy.
Joining us now to talk about the Wisconsin Historical Museum's Wisconsin Goes Hollywood exhibit is Leslie Belay, curator of Social social history for the Wisconsin Historical Society. Leslie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So where did the idea for this exhibit, where did it come from?
It mainly came from wanting to explore more Wisconsin identity and what makes Wisconsin, Wisconsin. And in this case, we're looking at how outsiders view Wisconsin and what they think of us.
So what do we see? What kind of memorabilia would we see visiting this exhibit?
Well, the exhibit divides into two parts mainly. One is a kind of hall of fame of famous actors and actresses, and we were able to acquire some of their costumes from their signature roles. For example, Kathy Kinney was Mimi Bombeck in the Drew Carey Show, and we have one of her wonderful costumes that we borrowed from Warner Brothers. We also have some that we have acquired for our collection along the way. On the other side of the exhibit is sort of that identity question, and we have things like a Schott's Brewery smock from Laverne and Shirley, and Happy Days Leopard League Lodge bowling shirt worn by Mrs. Cunningham. So bowling and beer, kind of two Wisconsin-Milwaukee associations.
So when you say acquire, what does that mean exactly? It sounds like in that one case, you have to give it back. Is that always the case?
No, we have some pieces that we've actually purchased at auction. And also the Farley family donated the Chris Farley collection to us about 8 years ago.
Oh, what's in that?
That has items from his childhood and teenage years, like his football jersey from Edgewood College, or Edgewood High School. He went to Edgewood High School. Sorry about that. His rugby jacket from Marquette College, and then things from Second City, SNL, and then also props and costumes from his four movies that he made before his death, and then also memorabilia related to his death.
And the black leather jacket from Black Sheep, I think, or it's a leather jacket from Black Sheep.
It's not a leather jacket. It's just a regular
sports jacket.
Coat,
okay.
But it's covered with buttons. Tim Matheson played his brother who was running for governor of Washington State. And so it's covered with buttons of Tim Matheson. And it gets kind of destroyed in the movie, and you can still see some of the destruction on it.
Well, tell us a range of some of the other Wisconsin originals who are showing up in this exhibit, some of the actors who are from Wisconsin and made it big.
Well, we have them kind of in chronological order by birth. Mm-hmm. The oldest one is Frederick March. So he's hitting in the silent era and early movie times. But probably the biggest name from those early years is Spencer Tracy. He was born in Milwaukee, went to Marquette Academy, then on to Ripon College. And from there, he decided to drop out with his friend Pat O'Brien and go on to Broadway in New York City and make his fame and fortune there. He was eventually called to Hollywood.
And who are some Wisconsinites who show up in this exhibit that people might be surprised to know about, that they were from Wisconsin?
There's probably a handful of them. I don't know if people know Mark Ruffalo, who was the Hulk, is from Kenosha and was born and raised there. Some others might be Charlotte Ray, who played Mrs. Garrett on Facts of Life.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that one.
Is from Milwaukee, and she was also born and raised there. Kurtwood Smith, who you might know as Red from That 70s Show, had his start in Wisconsin.
Which is set in Wisconsin.
It is set in Wisconsin, and we do have that feature there. We have the opening number from the show. I did research on that, if I could just go off onto a side here. I was really looking forward to finding out what the people who were doing That 70s Show thought of where the idea came from of doing it in Wisconsin. It turned out there was journals used by Mark Brazil, who was from whose first cousin lives in Wisconsin, so I was able to connect through there and find out, what made you think of doing Wisconsin and why is That 70s Show in Wisconsin? Well, it turns out his high school journals were written in Buffalo, New York. So it's actually, they're taking his journals from Buffalo, New York, and moving them to Wisconsin.
So what, as you mentioned, the bowling and the beer, looking at the multimedia parts of this and the way Wisconsin is portrayed, what does it mean when somebody says something in Wisconsin? What are they trying to say?
There's usually, I found two tropes that seem to be consistent. One is sort of that wholesome Midwestern concept. And the other one, which more focuses on Milwaukee, but can include Wisconsin, is a place worse than death. So, if you want to say, oh, there's some place, you know, I've been sent to someplace horrid, you send them to Wisconsin. The most obvious one of that is Dogma, when the two angels, one character asks the devil, oh, were they sent to hell? He goes, no, worse, Wisconsin.
That's the Kevin Smith film?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite reference in Wisconsin, going through all these Wisconsin-y movies?
Well, I like that one. That's probably my best one. I also like Love Actually, when Colin, who's English, who can't get together with any girls in England, goes to Wisconsin because they all fall in love with his accent, which they do. And he hooks up with three girls the night he arrives.
So what isn't said about Wisconsin movies that you think should be out there? What is underrepresented on TV and movies?
What you don't get a sense of is that we're an agricultural state, that this is farmland. They tend to focus more on the cities or on kind of the North Woods. I expected to see cows and dairy, and you didn't see that at all.
Well, Leslie, it sounds like fun. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Leslie Belay is a curator of the social history for the Wisconsin Historical Society. We've been talking about the Wisconsin Goes Hollywood exhibit. It's at the Wisconsin Historical Museum until February 13th.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Veterans Day. In just a few minutes, we'll talk about a Wisconsin effort to help veterans find jobs and start businesses.
First, according to the federal government, anywhere from 10 to 20% of veterans coming back from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have experienced post-traumatic stress disorder. On this Veterans Day, Danielle Kading reports on how vets in Duluth Superior are learning to live with PTSD.
Duluth's Mike Waldron served as a Marine during the first Iraq invasion. 5 years after coming home, he says he began experiencing symptoms of PTSD.
That's when I fell into the severe panic attacks. I thought they were heart attacks, and I was going to the hospital for them, thinking I was dying.
Waldron went to the hospital 5 times, but physically there was nothing wrong with him. As time went on, he says he began to have more trouble with daily life.
I stopped taking care of myself. I moved out of state, so I didn't have my family or friend support network, and I realized it was very difficult for me to trust other people. I had a hard time making friends, so I was isolated.
He got counseling and medication, but Waldron says it didn't work for him. He began to lose hope and didn't understand what was happening. That is, he says, until he started getting better.
I began working out and getting more involved in the community, and those two things combined were the biggest reasons I was able to pull out of the severe PTSD.
Waldron says the endorphins from exercise helped ward off his anxiety and feelings of hopelessness. Now, Waldron helps vets connect with community members and overcome their anxiety or depression as the Duluth chapter director of Team Red, White, and Blue.
So generally, we go out in the Duluth Superior area 40 times a month, and we do different physical activities and social activities.
Activities like rock climbing.
Put your right foot up there, up a little higher.
Caitlin Wood is climbing on a rock wall blindfolded as part of an exercise to build trust with team members. She and her husband recently moved to the area and decided to give it a go.
I think it's a good group for people who want to get out and do things. They just don't know how to do it, you know, and it just kind of brings people out. So I think it's a good cause for especially vets.
Her husband, Kevin, agrees. He served as a flight medic with the Minnesota National Guard.
You can tell that there's a lot of camaraderie with the group, so that kind of takes you back to the experiences that you've had in the military. So it definitely helps as far as getting together with people that have had similar experiences.
Victor Rigling of Duluth hasn't served in the military, but that doesn't stop him from hanging out with this group of veterans.
You know, seeing veterans get out, and a lot of people don't realize how isolated they really are. So being able to get out and help them, you know, get active and find a place back in the community has just been fantastic.
Buffy Munsell is a Hayward native that has taken part in Team Red, White, and Blue. A veteran of the Air Force Reserves, Munsell says she began experiencing PTSD after being sexually assaulted in the military and working with fallen service members at the Air Force mortuary.
What I want to make stop is the flashbacks and the nightmares and the anxiety and the depression and the feeling that I don't have control over my mind because it overtakes it.
But she says working out and spending time with the team has helped.
it does something to my mind. It releases those natural chemicals where I don't need antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications.
Monsell says she's just a happier person all around. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Mental health can be one challenge for veterans entering civilian life. Another issue that just about all veterans will deal with when they leave the services, what will they do for a living? According to numbers from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, veterans in general experience slightly higher unemployment rates, but veterans of the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were significantly more likely to be unemployed than their non-veteran peers.
Saul Newton is with us now. He's the executive director of the newly created Wisconsin Veterans Chamber of Commerce. He joins us from our studio in Milwaukee. Saul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what led you, Saul, to start this Veterans Chamber of Commerce here in the state?
Well, I'm a veteran myself, and I just saw that this was a need that wasn't being filled. There was no organization specifically dedicated to working with veterans who were looking to start their own business and connecting employers across the state with veterans who were looking for employment opportunities.
So how are you trying to tackle that problem with this new organization?
Well, what we do is we build a connection and bring together veterans who are looking for jobs with businesses who either are owned by veterans themselves or are just looking to work more closely with veterans, and we connect them. And we establish ourselves as a resource for businesses who are looking to hire veterans, and we refer them to veterans who are looking for work.
And talking to veterans who are in that looking for work situation, what kind of things do you hear from them? What kind of unique challenges might they be facing?
Well, the most unique challenge for veterans is translating the experience and the technical skills that they learned while they were in the military to a language and a point of reference that people who don't have that military background can understand. There's sometimes a challenge in translating those skills from the military world into the civilian world.
And I've seen the case made that veterans actually bring a lot of assets that nobody else really can because of that experience. So what are some of the selling points? How do you translate that into terms that an employer can understand?
Well, the simple fact of the matter is that veterans, through their military experience, possess skills and tools and technical know-how and values that make them extremely attractive employees. An employer that is looking to hire a veteran is looking for an employee who is who has integrity, who has discipline, and who has a sense of loyalty to accomplishing a task. And those are values that are instilled in every military member. And so what we do is we work with employers to really translate some of those values and those skills that they have into a language that they can understand.
Well, I imagine some employers might want people who can function in highly stressful, chaotic situations. I bet that's
Absolutely.
A big selling point there.
Absolutely. I mean, you really don't find a group of people who are more capable of working under pressure than someone who has served in the military, and especially someone who's been deployed to a war zone.
We're talking veterans and employment. On Veterans Day, we've got Saul Newton with us, so with the newly created Wisconsin Veterans Chamber of Commerce. So part of what you're doing, Saul, is trying to get businesses, employers to sign up who consider themselves veteran-friendly, who are open, maybe looking to hire veterans. So what kind of things do you hear from employers who want that kind of workplace?
Well, the number one thing that we hear is that a lot of times employers don't know where to look. You know, the commitment to hire military veterans is there. They just aren't aware of the resources that are out there to connect them with veterans who are looking for jobs. And there are several organizations in Wisconsin who work to connect military veterans and with employers and to give veterans the skills that they need to fill out a resume and to go into a job interview and teach some of those job-seeking skills. What we do is we work with the employer to make sure that they actually are following through on that commitment that they have, and they can actually turn that into a tangible benefit, which is hiring military veterans.
And another side of what you're trying to do that I don't want to overlook is helping the veterans maybe become employers themselves, get them into
Absolutely.
Entrepreneurship. So talk about making the transition from wartime service to business ownership.
Well, just as military veterans make fantastic employees because of the values that they learn and the skills that they learn, the same is true of entrepreneurship. Veterans are twice as likely to start their own business as non-veterans are. And it's because of those skills and those values and that discipline that you learn in the military that makes for a natural fit with a job creator, with a business owner. And so what we do is we work with veterans. We walk with them every step of the way from forming their own business to starting it and growing it, managing their brand and attracting new customers and really promoting that business as something that offers a service that people want to be a part of.
Can you talk about one or two of the veteran entrepreneurs that you've worked with?
Oh, absolutely. One that immediately comes to mind is a woman named Jessica Dragon, who she served in the Army for 4 years. And when she got out, she started her own massage therapy business. And what she does is she goes to people's homes, to their offices. She works with elderly patients and patients in hospice care and provides massage therapy to those patients. And the dedication that she has to her patients is really something to be admired.
One thing that occurs to me is that if you've been, say, here in Wisconsin all along, you've had an opportunity to develop networks over time, connections in the business and funding world and things like that, that you might not have had time to develop if, say, you were deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Is that part of the effort to jumpstart that networking that seems so key to business startups?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's something that veterans, especially newly returning veterans who are just getting out of the military, need to confront. They maybe don't have the same network, professional network or personal network, that would really benefit them as they start their journey in entrepreneurship. But the fact of the matter is that veterans have already in the state of Wisconsin started almost 40,000 businesses. They employ over 110,000 people. And up until now, there has not been a statewide network devoted specifically to working with that section of the business community. And so what we're trying to do is work with these businesses that maybe have felt overlooked or haven't been aware of the resources that are available to them as military veterans or as veteran-friendly businesses. And we really try to bring together and build this community dedicated to supporting one another.
We're talking to Saul Newton with the Wisconsin Veterans Chamber of Commerce. It's a new effort to connect veterans with jobs and help them to start new businesses, too.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a veteran? Did you hit obstacles in your job search? What helped and what didn't help? Or did you maybe start your own business? If you're an employer, do you make an effort to hire veterans at your workplace? Call us at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with Saul Newton, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Veterans Chamber of Commerce. We're looking at efforts to connect veterans with jobs and to help them start their own businesses.
You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your own experience. Does being a veteran make finding jobs more difficult? Does being a veteran give you a unique skill set that's an asset to employers or to being an entrepreneur yourself? And if you're someone who hires people, do you make an effort to hire veterans or want to ask about how you could go about doing that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. Pete is on the line with us in Appleton. Pete, hi.
Oh, hello, yes. Are you there?
Yep. What do you want to bring up, Pete?
Well, you talk about success. This is a very inspirational story for any vet listening. My dad served with in the Korean War with the Mills brothers before they started Mills Flea Farm, and they were just drafted into Korea, and they got out, and they, of course, everybody knows in Wisconsin how big Mills Flea Farm is, and they started out just from the bottom, you know. And also another man he served with, or brothers, the Leach family, which were in the Korean War drafted, and they built the Leach trucks, the garbage trucks.
Pete, thanks a lot for sharing that. Saul, yeah, I think if we look back to that era, World War II and the Korean War, we can find probably a lot of success stories with iconic businesses like Fleet Farm.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the more you look into it, the more you see that there are literally tens of thousands of businesses, some very well-known businesses here in Wisconsin that have been started by military veterans. And some of them you might not even know came from a military background. But it goes back to, you know, those skills that we talked about earlier, those values that are instilled through military service that make veterans particularly attractive entrepreneurs and employees.
I've seen comparisons between the World War II era in particular and now, where in the World War II era, it was not everybody served, but it was really normal to meet someone who had served in World War II. So much of the population, especially the male population, served then, whereas now it's more of an exception. Fewer people might personally have contact with veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. Does that make it a little harder, a little different sort of thing, maybe for employers?
Well, I think it's simply a lack of exposure. I think that you know, for some people, they might not have a personal interaction or a personal relationship with a military veteran that they know of. That doesn't mean that it isn't there. You know, about 60% of the U.S. population says that they have an immediate family member who served in the military at some point. You know, there are comparisons, especially with the latest generation, the post 9/11 generation of military veterans to that World War II generation, and I think that when you look at, you know, the qualities that these individuals have, these are individuals of character, of honor, of duty, and you know, tell me that that isn't somebody that you would want to have employed in your business or somebody that you might want to work with.
We heard earlier a feature on post-traumatic stress disorder here in Wisconsin, and there's been concern I've seen from veterans groups saying, yes, thanks for paying attention, it's an important health issue, but at the same time worried that maybe there's a stigma among the general populace, a fear even of veterans because of all this attention to PTSD. Do you see that playing out maybe in the hiring process?
Well, I think that Not to say that issues like mental health or housing security aren't deserving of attention, because they absolutely are, and you know, those are certainly challenges that members of the military and veterans community have to face. I think that there is a stereotype sometimes that veterans have to overcome, especially when they're working with someone who maybe doesn't have a background of knowledge in the military, simply that they need to show that, you know, they're no different than any other person applying for that job, other than the fact that they have these unique skill sets that really make them a better employee.
Talking to Saul Newton, he's executive director of the Wisconsin Veterans Chamber of Commerce, talking about connecting veterans with jobs, helping veterans become entrepreneurs, creating veteran-friendly workplaces in the state. Still time for calls with your experiences, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. Saul, you mentioned you hadn't seen other efforts like yours here in Wisconsin. Are you? Do you have models elsewhere in the country for this Veterans Chamber of Commerce?
Yeah, there are several other organizations, both working in other states across the country and some national organizations that are working on issues like entrepreneurship or employment. Really what's encouraging to see is that there's a lot of collaboration going on among leaders in the business community. It's very clear that this is a priority. And so, you know, it's important that we all work together and bring different things to the table to really tackle this issue, which is connecting veterans with jobs and helping them start their own business.
Saul, earlier you mentioned getting veterans in touch with things like job training, and I wonder about the GI Bill, things like that. What is out there for veterans to help with education and job training skills?
Oh, there are a litany of resources that are available. One of the challenges that veterans sometimes face is that they don't know the resources that are out there, or they know that they're out there, they don't know how to take advantage of them. And so that's something that we try to do. We work with veterans to connect them with the resources that would fit their needs. The other side of that issue is that really there are a lot of resources available to working with veterans to make them more attractive employees in terms of writing a resume or interview skills. But sometimes there aren't as many resources available to work with employers to actually give them the cultural competency, so to speak, that background of knowledge of knowing the difference between, you know, the branches of service beyond one's in the water and one's in the air and one's on the ground. Giving them that background of knowledge to actually be able to relate how If they're looking at two job applicants, one is 22 years old and fresh out of college, and one is 22 years old who just did 4 years in the Marines, why that military veteran might be a better fit for their organization.
Let's go back to our callers. Chad is on the line with us in Green Bay. Chad, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I started my own business as a veteran just because, you know, the civilian market, I didn't feel necessarily honored a lot of my experience. And I've heard a lot of other veterans that had similar, experiences just because, you know, they went in for infantry or something, for instance. They didn't really know how that was going to pan out for them in the civilian market. So they kind of, you know, had to go entrepreneurial. And I think it's really great that a lot of resources are available for veterans like myself.
And Chad, do you think that, that your military experience helped you out as a business owner, as an entrepreneur?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I kind of reverse engineered my way into the whole stage of where my business is, and it's been growing ever since. And I'm very proud of, you know, the commitment that I learned with military service.
Chad, thanks so much for sharing your story with us. Saul, good news there, but bad news too, in that Chad and his friends said the civilian businesses didn't know what to make of their military experience.
Absolutely. It's unfortunate. Unfortunately, it's not that uncommon. What we're seeing is that the commitment from many, many businesses to hire military veterans is real. It's genuine. They just don't know how to translate that commitment into action. One of the stories that really sticks with me is a young man who served 4 years in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. He applied for a job with a very well-known company who very highly promoted their commitment to hiring military veterans. He reworked his resume, took all the military jargon off, crossed all his T's and dotted all of his I's, and submitted his resume through a special website that was set up, and he never heard anything back. Now, he reapplied for the same job as a normal applicant and left his military experience off of his resume. And not only did he get called back for an interview, but he actually got hired for that position.
Wow.
And that's something that is not born out of an intent to do ill will or bad motivations. It's simply showing that there is a disconnect between the civilian sector and those with a military background.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Saul Newton, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Veterans Chamber of Commerce. This week, a police department in Wisconsin encountered a mystery, a casket, an empty casket on the side of the road discovered by the Adams County Sheriff's Department.
If this were the cartoons, they might have called Scooby-Doo and Mystery Inc. for help, but this being the real-life 21st century, they went to social media. On the Sheriff's Department Facebook page, they said they were looking for the owner of that casket. To avoid panic, they wrote, "We're pretty certain it did not come out of the ground, and there have been no reports of zombies in the area."
The story got a lot of attention in the social media world, and it's been hitting the national media, too. Kind of one of those news of the weird items. The owner evidently has stepped forward to claim the casket. It was used, apparently, for a fundraising Halloween hayride. It fell out of the boat that the owner was towing it around in to transport it.
I'm just going to leave the whole boat thing aside for a moment. The casket in the boat is blowing my mind, but how do you not notice you're missing a casket?
That it just, I don't know, it blew away,
windy day.
I don't know.
A casket.
I don't know. Well, I think this could have been the beginning of a really good David Lynch movie, but it turned out the real cause behind it was way, way less sinister. I'm not sure what I guess I'd just call the authorities if I found that on the side of the road.
I'm kind of glad it turned out the way it did.
Yes, very innocent.